This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Nuclear Cat, Aaron S., and Barb W. Thanks again for your support, friends. You can join the ranks of Blotter Tipsters at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with the show.
At issue was something Lewinsky had written, a sworn affidavit in which she claimed that she had never had a sexual relationship with Bill Clinton. The point of putting Lewinsky in the brace was to scare her into telling the truth and to convince her to help Ken Starr go after the person he was really interested in, the president.
Twenty years ago, the United States lived through the interminable sordidry known as the impeachment of Bill Clinton, although the chief trial was of our patience. Last week, the Slow Burn podcast turned its attention to this pettily tawdry period in American politics, and Canadian Alex Collins has politely agreed to turn her attention to the Slate podcast's second season, and to the recipient of one of Clinton's highest profile pardons, Patty Hearst, the still controversial subject of CNN's early 2018 podcast, Patty Has a Gun. Begin communique. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 64. Transmitting live to tape from the New York 11th, where the majority is, alas, not silent, it's The Blotter Presents. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm joined again today by Alex Collins. Hello, Alex.
Good morning. How are you?
I am very well. I am very excited to dig into the second season of Slow Burn with you in our Most Wanted section. So the first season of Slow Burn, very well regarded podcast about some of the lesser known stories and facts of the Watergate scandal and impeachment. That was the subject of their first season. The second season returned August 8th and concerns itself with the impeachment of Bill Clinton. We lived with this all day, every day, when I was in my early 20s, to the point where our esteemed colleague and friend of the podcast, past guest John Ramos, and a couple of friends and I were taking a train to New Haven. We bought the Star Report in paperback in Grand Central, ripped it into thirds, and were just passing it around. And then the whole rest of the car got into the act, and we were doing like declamatory readings with poetical line breaks and shit. Because this is how you had to like process the fact that this is what we're supposed to care about. Anyway, in case you have either put this out of your mind or can't quite believe it actually happened, here's the case file. The impeachment of Bill Clinton was initiated in December 1998 by the House of Representatives and led to a trial in the Senate for the impeachment of Clinton on two charges, one of perjury and one of obstruction of justice, which stemmed in turn from a sexual harassment lawsuit brought by Paula Jones. These specific charges arose from an investigation by independent counsel and former Solicitor General Ken Starr. Starr conducted a wide-ranging investigation, understatement, of alleged abuses, including the Whitewater affair, the firing of White House travel agents, and the alleged misuse of FBI files. On January 12, 1998, Linda Tripp, who had been working with the Jones lawyers, informed Starr that Lewinsky was preparing to commit perjury in the Jones case and had asked Tripp to do the same. So that's where we kind of come into the Slow Burn podcast. That case file was adapted from Wikipedia and frankly is not helping to clarify matters to me at all. Before we get into some clips and talking about the actual podcast, Alex, what was your experience of this? I don't even want to say case, although this is a true crime podcast. That's what we're doing here. But while this was all going on, how were you receiving it?
So, and I found this interesting with the host because he talked about how he was sort of like in middle school when this was going on, and it was similar for me. I was sort of a young teenager in Canada, and but always sort of fascinated with, you know, pop culture, true crime, politics, and followed it. But so I was aware of it, and I remember, you know, he talked about in the podcast feeling you know, being raised by Democrats and sort of, you know, feeling an allegiance to Clinton, that he, you know, it was a witch hunt by star. So I sort of had that feeling, but I think really for me, my biggest sort of familiarity with it was honestly bad Monica Lewinsky jokes. You know, my dad would tell them and I'd hear them around. And that was really, I think, my most exposure to that. And when we got through this podcast, that made me feel really gross almost, that that was so much of what I knew about it. And I hated that.
Yeah, I, in retrospect, I think we all told those jokes, laughed at those jokes. I certainly, being pretty much the same age as Monica Lewinsky, I think I'm like a year or two older than she is. She, I mean, I didn't see her as a victim at the time. And I felt, I agreed with the host and sort of the family that I was raised in and feeling, although my dad was not a big Clinton fan, he was a like Reagan progressive, feeling that this was really about something else for the people going after Clinton was A, and B, I had no sympathy or compassion for Monica Lewinsky or really anybody else who got caught up in this. I just thought it was kind of pathetic and trashy, and I feel shitty about that now, because she was like, I was, you know, a young jackass also at this time who got embroiled with bad or dudes who were bad for me. And I don't know, like, I would like to apologize to her. Yeah. Not that she is consuming any media about herself, nor should she be. Don't read the comments, Monica, but oh, sorry, girl.
No, 100%. Like, that's sort of how I feel. And what I pulled away from this podcast too, something that I liked was how her story being told in it. And like, she was a pretty cool person, I've got to say, leading through just what we're talking about and how she handled it, and very human in it all. And I think that's what really came across for me. And I hope that the podcast continues to look at that, and Slow Burn really sort of delves into her a little bit more and how she kind of reacted and dealt with it and her story within it a little bit more, because I do think she deserves to be sort of humanized in this whole thing pretty well.
Well, and the pictures that you would always see then and now of her gazing adoringly at Clinton, just a quick sort of like semi-personal contact story. As I mentioned before, my dad is a fiscal conservative and a social, like, who cares her? And it's just like, okay. Yeah. So that's why he voted Republican so long and why he can no longer do so. But he was playing golf with some client up near where the Clintons lived while Hillary was the senator for New York, one of the senators for New York. And my dad had left something in the clubhouse. So he's like steaming around like some curve in the clubhouse, going back to his locker to get something or other, his wallet, I don't know. And he notices that there are dudes in suits around, and he remembers vaguely that the former president was at the club but hadn't really been paying attention, rounds a corner and crashes into Bill Clinton, who was like super nice about it. Like, one Secret Service guy kind of comes over and my dad's like, oh my gosh, like, Mr. President, I'm so sorry. And Bill Clinton was like, my dad is a financial manager who got screwed on behalf of his clients by a lot of Clinton policies, and called him Slick Willie and did not like this person, and came home like a starry-eyed schoolgirl, like writing Mr. Dave Clinton on his peachy folder. And my mom was like, wow. Like, all of this to say that this man's personal charisma is intense. If my dad came home and was like, he was so nice, like, oh my god, dad, do you hear yourself? But couple this with the positions of power that he has found himself in for most of his adult life, and like, it's just a perfect storm of hashtag me too, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. So
100%. That's very much how I feel too.
Yeah. And the podcast does get into this, but let's get into the podcast. You actually called for our first clip, in which they're talking about, basically grabbing up Monica and taking her to this hotel room and trying to brace her, as we heard in our clip up top. What struck you about the clip that we're about to hear?
Well, it's going back to, I think, what we were just talking about too. And, you know, that I think Monica Lewinsky herself kind of got lost in this whole, I mean, again, back to what you're saying, I don't really know what to call it, this whole thing that happened. And for me, this, I really loved what they talked about in the clip and telling the story of how she handled it, because I found when we looked through it, there was this real piece where in one moment she was pretty tough and, you know, resolved and determined on this. But in another point, you know, this was really hard for her, and it talked about, you know, her mom having to go back with her that night and make sure she didn't hurt herself, things like that. But the first clip we talk about, I have been, since I listened to this podcast, I have been telling everybody, I was like, guess what Monica said? So I think if you play that, because I loved it.
Yeah, that really did sort of change the game for me in terms of my feelings about her backbone. Here's clip two. Yeah.
The first mistake came when the FBI agents who brought Lewinsky into the hotel room for some reason allowed Linda Tripp to join everyone inside. Lewinsky, who understood immediately that Tripp had betrayed her, stared at her former friend with rage in her eyes. Before someone finally thought to get Tripp out of the room, Lewinsky remembers saying, "Make her stay and watch. I want that treacherous bitch to see what she's done to me."
Treacherous bitch. Atta girl.
Yeah, like, oh, I just kind of went, oh my God, I want to have wine with this woman. Like, I want to sit down and just be like, let's be friends.
I know. Like, yeah, I think we're all sort of aligned on a wavelength that we didn't even realize. I am looking forward to how Slow Burn gets into Linda Tripp's role in this, because Linda Tripp, I think I was not fair to her physical presentation either back in the day, and I'm just going to leave it at that. But
yeah,
her, the way that she carried herself in the world was perhaps not designed to create sympathy. Maybe I'll just leave it there.
Well, and it's funny. I mean, when I say I feel really differently and I don't feel great about Monica Lewinsky in this thing, I feel no shame or regret about thinking Linda Tripp is a horrible person. Like, I still think, and maybe that'll change in this, but not many redeeming pieces there for her yet.
Well, the thing is, like, I am going to need this podcast to hold my hand and take me through the many sort of gossamer threads that created this rope with which they tried to hang Clinton. Clip three, they sort of give an overview about what we're all doing here that I thought was really well done. It didn't get into too much detail, but it sort of said, look, this is a complicated swirl of factors, and here's what they are. And the other thing is, I think we really tend to forget how central Paula Jones was to all of this, and certainly I was not fair to her back then. But here is our host, Leon Nafok. I think that's how he pronounces it, so I'm going to go with it. Sort of letting us know what we're all doing here in clip three.
Jones alleges that in 1991, then Governor Clinton lured her to a private room at this Little Rock Hotel during a state conference and made unwanted sexual advances.
Here's what you need to understand about how all this fits together. Basically, three separate storylines converged to put Bill Clinton's presidency in peril. The first was Ken Starr's investigation into the Clintons' financial history and Whitewater.
The president's biggest headache, special prosecutor Kenneth Starr's Whitewater investigation.
The second was Paula Jones' sexual harassment suit.
Paula Jones' sexual misconduct allegations against President Clinton continue to wreak havoc among members of the White House staff.
The third was Clinton's relationship with Monica Lewinsky.
I mean, I think that we were not prepared 20 years ago to receive what we saw as Clinton's tacky behavior as criminal. And I think that we are in a different place today with that. Would you agree?
I would think in one regard, yes. But in another, side of it too, it's not like the president that, you know, the U.S. has now is a pillar of decorum and lack of tact, you know, tackiness when it comes to that. So, I mean, I really kind of struggled with that when, you know, when we talk about that here in the podcast, is it better or is it not? And I almost don't have the answer. I think there's more awareness of it, but whether or not that's changing attitudes and behaviors, you know, broadly, I don't know. And I guess that's that broader Me Too question that exists, is if it's changing. And but something that, you know, relates to that, that you touched on just before the clip, that I'm really hoping that the podcast digs into more, is Paula Jones herself and that story, because I do think, similar to Monica Lewinsky, Paula Jones became a little bit of a caricature in this whole thing, who, I mean, for all I know, really was a legitimate victim and deserved more than she got to, from, you know, how she was portrayed and how she was treated. And I'm hoping to learn more about that through the series.
Yeah, I think I think that any coverage of her is going to raise very important questions about the idea of the quote perfect victim when it comes to rape, sexual assault, sexual misconduct and harassment, that this is not something that should be a requisite for filing a complaint of wrongdoing or, you know, assault, that, you know, you're not the hippest person, you don't have the cleanest romantic history, doesn't matter.
Exactly.
So I'm hoping they get into that, and I'm pretty hopeful that they will, because this is a podcast that its opening shot in Watergate was about Martha Mitchell, who was this, like, I was like, she sounds amazing. And then they get to the part where she died when I was like two, and I was like, God damn it. Now we don't get to hang out. I'm upset.
And when we talked about looking at this pod or slow burn for this podcast, I went back and listened to the Watergate one, because I hadn't heard of it before. And I loved it, and it gives me a lot of faith for how this story is going, how they're going to tell this piece too. Because what I liked about how Slow Burn itself was set up is that it has the structure where it is a chronological telling of the story, but they kind of focus in on events or themes and story tell through it, but make sure you get the context and the information within that story. And I really, really enjoyed that from the first season of it. And we, you know, we're a little bit of a house full of nerds. So after we watched, my daughter and I went and saw The Post, and then that kind of sent us down
a
spiral, because she's 12. So she doesn't know anything about, you know, Watergate and Nixon era stuff. So we kind of started to learn more about and reading about Watergate. And, you know, we watched All the President's Men and did all that. And when I saw that podcast and I started listening to the Martha episode, I said, you know, I think she would dig listening this with me. And we really did. Like, we put it on the car, and the Martha episode, I loved. Like, I was hooked immediately. And then we just listened to the Saturday Night, where they talked about, you know, how everything went down, and with the Nixon, when, you know, the Archibald Cox resigned, and that whole night, and they told such a pivotal moment of that story within the context of one night. And I just, like I said, I found it was such a great way of storytelling that I'm really excited to see how they apply that here. And even, like you said, in the clip you just played, how he laid out, like, these were the three pieces and this is what we're going to look at. I thought that was a really well done way to break down the story, so it's almost digestible, and it's interesting, but you're going to be able to follow along with it too.
Yeah. And there's also, I mean, I feel like for Americans, that, like, All the President's Men is like, even if you've never actually seen it from beginning to end, you know it. And several friends of mine, and also myself, and particularly I'm thinking of my guest from last week, Mike Dunn, have been, like, trading all of their, like, Nixon and Final Days, like, books, and just reading them at bedtime to self-soothe about the current administration. That it's like, this could turn out. Like, we could maybe figure this out. But I like that it's a huge topic. And there are a lot of legal issues in play, both Watergate and the Clinton impeachment. And it was something that was relentlessly covered. So the I think the particular talent that slow burn has is to find ways into it that make it digestible, like you said.
And I feel too that there's this undercurrent, and maybe I'm just sort of reading into it, but I find there's a really nice undercurrent. I found this again with the first season and even starting to listen to this one, of not overtly, but sort of subtly drawing parallels to the current administration and how that's working. And and maybe, like I said, maybe I'm just drawing them myself because there are so many that kind of exist there. But I found that kind of interesting too. And I think with this one, the Clinton one, there's gonna be interesting pieces when it comes to, you know, the sexual harassment piece that's happening now and with the current administration, how that kind of compares. And I think there is a, you know, a comparison to be made between the two, and 20 years later, has it changed or has it not?
Yeah. They get pretty impressive access. I think that they'll have even better luck this season because of not just the success of the first season, but the fact that this stuff happened. Like, my parents still talk about the Saturday Night Massacre like it was a thriller that they saw last week. I was 4 months old. This happened a while ago, but, you know, people have died. Like, it was a long time ago. This is not quite as long ago, so they will have access to a lot of the key players. And I was impressed as far as the first episode and the range of people that they got to comment. But Monica Lewinsky herself has declined to participate. Again, I totally get it. But we do hear her in some found clips. Shall I play clip 4 and then you can talk about why you asked for it?
Please do.
All right, here we go.
I was threatened with up to 27 years in jail for denying the affair in an affidavit and other alleged crimes. 27 years. When you're only 24 yourself, that's a long time.
Yeah, it is. And you have to wonder if they would have come at a dude like that.
Yep. It almost, and even hearing her now when I listen to this again, it gives me a little bit of chills just to think about, again, this was a human being who all of this happened to. It was a woman in her young 20s who was just, I cannot imagine what that was like for her to go through and to try to come out. And the fact that she managed to come out the other end and get a life back, I think is pretty astonishing, because I couldn't even imagine putting myself in her shoes and just the hell she went through for a long time. And she is still a little bit of a punchline. And
well, that's the thing. Like, this got to define her life.
Yeah.
And she didn't get a say. And this is still going to be the lead in the obit, as they say, unless she kills someone, which I have some suggestions. Just kidding. Prank caller. Yeah. So our next clip is not long after the one you just called for. And there's some interesting insights here as well, in terms of not just what the prosecutors expected to happen should their charges against her proceed to trial, but how they expected her to react to these threats, I think, is pretty telling. Here's clip 5.
But in reality, no jury was ever going to convict a 24-year-old woman for lying about an adulterous affair. Even the hardliners on Ken Starr's team had to know this. Plus, they knew they didn't have much evidence on Lewinsky. Here's Udolph.
At that particular point, it was not necessarily known to us that this relationship was not a figment of a young, impressionable girl's mind.
The lack of evidence didn't stop the prosecutors from telling Lewinsky that she faced grave consequences unless she agreed to cooperate with them. They told her that if she wanted to make a deal, she would have to move fast, because her value as a witness would only go down. Lewinsky had a guess as to why the prosecutors were in such a hurry.
Good evening. There's never been anything quite like it before. A president of the United States in the same room with a woman who has accused him of sexual harassment.
As Lewinsky and just about everyone else in America knew, Bill Clinton was set to give a deposition in the Paula Jones lawsuit the following day.
Yeah, so she's not an idiot, but in the same clip, you have the fact that she's savvy enough to know what they need and what they're trying to leverage her with/for, but also that even at this distance, and as we'll hear in a later clip, regretting a lot of his part in all of this. One of the guys on Ken Starr, he was on Ken Starr's team, right? Bruce Udolph?
Yeah, he was one of my favorite players through this so far.
Definitely. But that he said sort of, I'm sure he thinks better of it in hindsight, but or is talking about how this was his mindset at the time, I should say. But that they're kind of like, well, we don't even, like, she could be making all this up. She could just have a crush.
Yeah.
Like, there's just something about the way that this entire situation never lost an opportunity to diminish Monica Lewinsky because of her age and gender. And it's really gross to watch. And once again, I feel gross for kind of having participated in it.
Yeah. And everybody did, right? Like, that was the thing. And I wonder, again, I mean, I know this is a little bit of a harp on it, but I think it is a theme of this is, you know, have things changed in 20 years since that? Maybe a little, but I don't know that they've changed, you know, dramatically. That how seriously do we take young women who are considered silly in these sorts of things, right? And that's how you look at it. So, yeah, and I, but it is, it's just, I just feel gross all around about how it was, but there's just such an interesting story, again, that comes from her and when they're talking about, you know, how the operation went. And you had the swings of her being, you know, them talking about her sobbing and being really emotional when she's confronted with it. But then, you know, they went shopping and she went into Crate and Barrel and was making jokes. And then back in the evening when she went, you know, her mother came to get her and thank God on the advice of a family lawyer, you know, told them to leave. And I talked about this. Her brother said, you know, she was afraid that she was going to hurt herself and told her she had to leave the bathroom door open and things. And so I just, but I mean, that to me pretty accurately describes someone in their early 20s, you know?
Well, like, and then you also have, I think, the question of false confessions. Like, she was detained, and that's always a, I watch a lot of live PD, not proud of it, but it is what it is. And beat cops often say, like, you're not under arrest, you're being detained for your own safety and mine. Like, that's an awful fine hair that you're splitting. Mm-hmm. And of course, like, she's 24, she's surrounded by grown-up dudes, she has had this affair, and she knows that Trip has sold her out and that somehow she's in trouble for this. But then you have to wonder, like, with everything that we now know about the way that confessions are obtained, like, what were they hoping to get out of her that they could actually use? Like, probably nothing. And then they were just going to leave her at the curb to fend for herself, which is what they did. But in terms of talking about how things have changed, your next clip has a unearned reference to hashtag Me Too. Shall we listen to that and then fume about Udolph's colleague?
Please do.
Let's. Here's clip six.
Udolph told me he'd heard that one of his former colleagues from the Star team had recently said in an interview that he was proud of the work the office had done on the Lewinsky case. The guy apparently said he felt vindicated by the Me Too movement. The world had caught up to the idea that powerful men shouldn't take advantage of young women and that Bill Clinton deserved to be taken down. Udolph finds that line of reasoning appalling.
The humiliation and hurt to Monica Lewinsky, the hell with that. She's expendable. Is that something to be proud of? Does that vindicate one for advocating that kind of position? I don't think so.
Udolph, clap, clap. Udolph, clap, clap.
Thank God for this clip. Like, you know, and him in this piece. So for me too, that this was something that when you brought up doing this podcast and this topic that I've always felt uneasy about. And it sort of brought those feelings back when I did a degree a few years ago. I had a prof that talked about it was, I think this was during the Bush years, and a conservative male, you know, prof talking about how Clinton was so much, you know, essentially worse than Bush because he had this sexual harassment thing and it's not okay to have a relationship with an intern. And then I remember just feeling sort of conflicted because, yeah, that's not okay. Like, what you know, Bill Clinton did with Monica Lewinsky is, you know, it's not all right. But then I really struggle to sort of reconcile that with the broader issue of where's this line and where does it fit? And I think Udolf summed it up so well that Monica Lewinsky was made a victim by Clinton, but she was made a victim by the whole Ken Starr investigation. It wasn't her choice to come forward, and you can't, you know, out her like that and take over her life. She was, and it's not like they were doing it for her protection or, you know, for her.
Yeah.
They did it for their own causes, and to try to pull that in now, like, to use what you did to her and try to justify it through that, like, it just, even talking about it now, like, I'm turning 9 shades of red and my skin is crawling. Like, you ruined this woman's life, and now you're going to try to say you did it for her? Like, go to hell.
Well, and there is that, you know, you're in this, like, Venn overlap as a progressive who, you know, I voted for Clinton, and it's like, you're in this weird, like, Venn overlap of, like, you know that what he did was wrong. But you also see, especially from this distance, like, that you're in the middle of, like, the Contract for America and the government shutdown and him, Clinton, having to track towards the center to get anything done. And this feeling that the country is dividing further and further, like the polls are getting further and further apart.
Yeah.
And that what is happening here is not like Udolf's colleague being like, hashtag justice for Monica, like, go fuck yourself. That's not what this is about for you. What this is about for you is your smug, hypocritical leveraging of this president's failings and possible felonies. Like, I'm not letting Clinton off the hook. But the way that it was used and the way that everyone around him was used to get to him, particularly Monica Lewinsky, who, like, what is she supposed to do? Change her name and move to Europe?
Exactly.
It's probably what I would have done, but it's, you know, not an appealing option.
No. And I think, I mean, it's what's interesting, too, when we talk about sort of the, you know, the taking the Slow Burn podcast from Nixon to Clinton, and when you look at it now, you know, there's this level of partisanship, I think, that just keeps growing and is so much of, you know, the problem of what led to that happening is you just feel so, I think, you know, caught in this partisan box that you have to do, and so it's anything for that. And I feel like this is a real interesting jumping off point that leads us to the partisanship that I think is so much of the problem that's happening and dividing the states right now. And the Nixon era, I mean, that was, they talked about it in the first Slow Burn as, you know, it was a little, it existed, and I think it enabled a lot of what happened and what Nixon was doing. It enabled it to happen for as long as it did. But at the end of it, it was the people who were involved who could look beyond partisan politics that's where, you know, right ultimately prevailed, because there were people who could do that.
You had the same issue. We were listening about, I can't remember his name. He's the guy from North Carolina, which is where my husband Dan is from. And when we were listening to it, I was like, oh, it's your boy Sam. And he's like, just a reminder, he was a segregationist. Like, back then, if your rooting interest, quote unquote, was in the people trying to prove that Nixon knew about all this stuff and was guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, you had to sort of get in rooting interest bed with some like racist, shitty characters. And you see the same thing here, and you see the same thing today. I don't know. We need a parliamentary system. I am not a crackpot.
That's good. I'm Canadian. I don't know how long you want me to start going on the systems.
Well, let's wrap it up with one final clip. I'd also like to note, Slow Burn is pretty short. Like, there's like a bunch of ads in it, and it still comes in at what, like 40 minutes an episode, 50 minutes an episode, if that. Like, they get a lot done.
Yeah.
It's really amazing, and they just jump right in. Leon is an excellent narrator. The build is really good. In case it's not clear, we love the podcast. We recommend it. And I think crimes were committed here. I'm just not sure Clinton was responsible for all of them. But here's an interesting comment from towards the end of the season premiere. Just talking about trying to compare how we felt about this then to how we feel about it now in our final Most Wanted clip.
I want to excavate the ideas that swirled around the Clinton saga. Ideas about sex and power and privacy and character. And I want to consider how those ideas have changed since the 1990s. Are we more enlightened now? Or is there something we're not appreciating about what it was like to live through this story in real time?
I think both can be true, and I have every confidence that he's going to keep both those plates in the air. And I'm looking forward to hearing all of the stories and feeling guilty about Paula Jones as well as Monica Lewinsky. Sorry, girl.
I think that's a fair place where this is going to go. And I love the podcast. I think I'm actually going to subscribe to Slate and get the extra bonuses too, because even the bonus pieces, some of them sounded interesting, and that's not usually where I go with it, but I really enjoyed how they're telling the story.
I'm definitely going to do that, because I think it's like not just like after show garbage, it's like extended interviews that really have a lot to them. But if you want to hear more, which I definitely do, we'll have a link in the show notes, but that's Slow Burn from Slate, and it's on all your fine podcast apps. So now it's time to move on to, besides Mark Rich, Bill Clinton's highest profile pardon, and that's Patty Hearst. As it happens, I am in the middle of the 15 and a half hour unabridged audiobook version of Jeffrey Toobin's American Heiress. And I'm not saying it's not good, but I'm in a tough spot with this, because I am I like to finish books. I hate leaving them in the middle. But like, this podcast does everything the book does with Toobin, like, quote, reading it, and in much more efficient fashion, so I think I might quit the book. But anyway, this is a podcast from CNN that aired earlier this year in conjunction with both the publication of American Heiress and a CNN series about Patty Hearst, I think.
And I watched the CNN series when came out, and I liked it. It was one of those that, you know, like so many of the PBS things I digest, that sometimes I, you know, intently watch it, and sometimes I sort of have it on while I'm puttering around or folding laundry or doing whatever. But I remember like generally enjoying it and, you know, waiting for the next episode to, you know, to come on the DVR and get ready to watch it. So it was pretty good. It was interesting, and it all started to, a lot of it came back to me from the podcast, you know, as I listened to that. And Toobin, and he was in the, I'm almost positive, was in the CNN TV series too.
Yes, I think he was. I think there was some kind of flap in the press about her portrayal in the series. I will link to some of that coverage in the show notes. But in case you're not familiar with who we're talking about, here's the case file. Since this was contemporaneous with Watergate, so my mother is like breastfeeding me and the world is going fucking crazy on the TV while this is happening. So if you ever wonder, Sarah, why are you like this? This could be why. Anyway, here is the case file from the iTunes description of Patty Has a Gun. In February 1974, a radical organization called the SLA shocked America with the kidnapping of 19-year-old newspaper heiress Patricia Hearst. But within weeks, the young woman known to the world as Patty would do something even more disturbing. She would join her captors in their violent crimes. It created a chilling question that still divides America today. Was Patty Hearst a victim of brainwashing, or did this California college student willingly become an armed terrorist? With help from expert analysts, this CNN podcast reexamines the evidence. And they do get some good experts. We don't have a clip of him, but Brian Burrow, who does a lot of long form work for Vanity Fair and has written several books about various like financial crimes, is on there. And I had no idea he even sounded like that. And he was an excellent commentator, and you should check out his books. I really liked this podcast. Mm-hmm. I feel a little bad for Tubin that it does the work of his book in a tenth of the time. But I haven't listened to the whole thing yet. Have you listened to the whole, you've listened to the whole podcast, the whole series?
I made it, I think I did about, so I watched the entire CNN series, but that was months ago. And I think I made it about halfway through the podcast series when I was cleaning out our office the other day. I just sort of put it on and, you know, made notes as we went through. But they all sort of play really well into each other too. Like it's the podcast version of a book. Like really, I mean, to get to your point of what you're talking about with Tubin, like it really does just sort of tell that with interviews and clips, and it was really well done.
Yeah, and Tubin's book is good. It's read by a guy named, I think, Paul Michael, and it's good. Like there are some points where it's like you get that thing you get in nonfiction books sometimes where like the author did this research and he's good goddamned if he's leaving anything out, and you're like, yeah, I don't necessarily need to know about real estate prices in Inglewood in 1969, but thanks. But it's good. It's well paced. Tubin's book on OJ was also outstanding. But these like inside the Tubin studio conversations with him, I think this is where he's actually a Viking, because he gets so much atmosphere and detail into these conversations. Let's hear clip 8, in which he's talking about how just like terrorist bombings were kind of, you know, must be Tuesday back in the mid 70s. And in fact, that my impression that the world had gone fucking crazy was accurate. Here's clip 8.
And one of the shocking things to me about the 1970s was what a wreck the United States was. Let me give you one statistic, which is the one that I think is the single most bizarre in my book. In the early and mid 1970s, there were nearly 2,000 political bombings a year in the United States.
At 1 minute before 1 o'clock this morning, the switchboard at the Capitol received a phone call. A man's voice said a bomb would go off in the building in half an hour. At 1:30 in the morning, it did. As it was, the violent explosion ripped off doors in nearby conference rooms. There was alarm for a time that other bombs might still be hidden inside the Capitol.
There were several every week in California alone.
Yeah, I mean, wow, that's a lot of bombings.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, this podcast is very good at giving you an atmospheric sense of the mid-70s. And they talk at one point about this feeling that like the world had sort of gone mad, and this like disorienting feeling, especially looking at what had become of the counterculture, that everyone had moved on and the counterculture was like, but no, like food for everyone. And there was a way that they described that disorientation that I found very relatable living in these non-United States right now. That's like things happen and are revealed and it doesn't seem to matter. Like,
yeah. And it feels very like you definitely get a feeling of, you know, chaos when you listen to it. And it does a really good job, I think, laying out that setting with, you know, that where this happened and how you feel like, you know, this all kind of went down. And it, yeah, I just thought it really, you know, set the scene very well heading into the story.
Our next clip is basically me never being able to resist an opportunity to actors, am I right? So I'm going to do that. But also, this was an enjoyable moment about between a couple of olds, host Brian Stelter and Tubin, talking about newspapers and hoping that listeners know what they are. Here's clip 9.
Oddly, three of the original kidnappers came from the Indiana University Theater Program, and they were believers in guerrilla theater. And they wanted to make a dramatic statement, and they thought, who could we kidnap that would make an incredible statement? And what they settled on was a Hearst, because at the remove of 40 years, it is difficult to envision and remember and know how famous the Hearst name was in the 1970s, because William Randolph Hearst, Patricia's grandfather, whom she never met, he died before she was born, was the first and greatest newspaper baron in the United States. And maybe we want to advise our viewers, do you think our listeners know what a newspaper is? they came on paper.
Ha ha, except really.
I know.
Yeah.
I hate that. Like, I always, when that joke came on, I went, ugh, you know, and I'm married to a former newspaper, you know, person who no longer works in newspaper. So I kind of went, yeah, I guess I got to hand it to them. Yeah. Like, I can't be that mad about it.
I'm married to a former theater kid. So, yeah, we all had our moments in that clip. But, yeah, they talk in a later episode, I think episode 3, which we have a different clip from. Just giving context of, like, who were the, like, American royalty names back then. Mm-hmm. It was, like, Hearst, Geddes, at, you know, one of whom was also kidnapped around this time. Rockefellers, and that was, you know, those were the names. And they really got into William Randolph Hearst and San Simeon and Citizen Kane and all that stuff. So this is definitely good at... I was creating a customized recommendations list for a listener who said that she really actually likes not so much crime stories, but like, this crime happened and here's the whole context. Like, here's, you know, here's where we were with everyone having electricity or not. And the telegram had just been invented, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I definitely like that too, that it's like, here's this crime, but here's how history led up to and then away from it. And this podcast is quite good at that.
Well, and I love that. I like that sort of method of doing it too, because it's interesting storytelling, and it allows you to draw your own parallels to where, you know, the context of what led to, you know, whatever happened in history. But then also, yeah, like I said, draw some parallels to where you are now and where you can find comparisons. And I just always like that method of doing it, because it makes you, it's easy to follow, but lets you think about it a little bit too.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of parallels, there are a number of parallels, I think, between Ms. Hearst's situation and Ms. Lewinsky's. Mm-hmm. In terms of the youth of these ladies at the time that everything critical happened for them, and also the freedom that everyone felt, myself not excluded, to project judgments onto them about how they responded. So you called for this next clip, and I feel that's probably where you were going with it. Do you have any comments before we hear clip 10?
Nope, that's pretty much it.
All right, here we go.
There are times when I am critical of Patricia Hearst and her behavior, but I never understate the terror that she must have felt when she was thrown into that trunk. You know, we have no tradition of political kidnappings in the United States. To this day, 2018, we have had one political kidnapping in the United States history. It's the Patty Hearst case. You know, there have been multiple kidnappings for money, but the idea of kidnapping someone for a political goal has happened once. And it was deeply, deeply terrifying, because when they broke into the house on February 4th, bad as it was, Stephen and Patty thought, well, this is a robbery and they'll take the stuff and leave. They took Patty, and the magnitude of her terror can hardly be overstated.
I think that's, I'm really glad that you called for that clip, because I think that's something that gets lost, even like, for me, sort of listening to this podcast and also to American Heiress, that because there's like, not confirmation bias exactly, but because she was not killed and because of what happened later, I think we sometimes forget mm-hmm. what it must have been like in the beginning. That it's like, she didn't know she wasn't going to be killed. I'm not sure the SLA knew she wasn't going to be killed. And then she's put in a closet, and then they put a TV in there, and then she, quote-unquote, forms a relationship with mm-hmm. Willie Wolfe. At least the podcast, and certainly the book, repeat many times that whatever she said she felt, she was not in a position to give consent to a captor, which is, you know, thank you for that. But I really like that Tubin made this point that he's like, you know, should she have helped rob a bank? Maybe not. But let's remember what it must have been like for her.
Well, and that's, and I, the reason I like that clip so much is it really sort of summed up, because there's so many conflicting feelings about this. And I think we talked, that's a similarity with the Clinton case, is you just feel conflicted because you know that it's not right to, you know, commit violent crimes, but you can't look at that alone with Patty Hearst, you know, and how can I judge somebody? I don't know what that was like. And I had tried to see if I could pull the clip where they described the kidnapping itself and how just chaotic and insane it was. And, you know, they were threatening to shoot the neighbors and there was a cop who showed up, and just the terror that she must have felt, you know, being thrown in that trunk and hearing everything and where it was. And then, like you said, being thrown in a closet. And I am just don't feel like I'm in a position to judge what she did next, because I don't know what you do to survive in that situation and what you need to do. And I think it's easy to look at, you know, the poor little rich girl, Patty Hearst, and sort of go, yeah, but she didn't have to rob a bank. But
they talk about this later, that like, because she took the name Tanya and began to espouse the principles, such as they were, disorganized as they might have been, of the SLA, that she was lumped in with the like spoiled white privilege rebellion of like, you know, upper class teenagers who were part of the anti-war movement. And it's like, okay, but when you look back at the bull sessions that you had at 19 and some of the positions that you took and how easily you might have been swayed by any argument just sitting in your dorm room, never mind if you're in a closet at gunpoint. Like, I don't particularly want anyone looking at the members of groups I was part of when I was 19. They all involved marijuana, but that's not the point.
Do we really know, and are you able to say with certainty that in that situation, your future wouldn't have gone in a similar way? And I do think it's, you can almost say that, do we think that Patty Hearst would have led that life had she not been kidnapped? Because I don't think she would have, you know, had the kidnapping not happened, would have gone out and started violently robbing banks.
No.
Don't think so.
Yeah. Seems like a long shot.
Yeah.
My last clip that I called for, it's funny how many of these famous like legal precedents that we think we know what they're from, but we actually don't, come from the Bay Area. The other one I'm thinking of is the Twinkie defense, which it was like, oh wait, but it was that guy? I thought it was just some random shooting, but no, it was Harvey Milk. Like, wow, that's crazy. Dan White had many problems, and I hope wherever he is, he's sorted them out.
Yeah, we'll leave that one there.
That's a whole nother podcast, and you're welcome to come back and talk about that. But
I'd be open for it.
This one, I did not know that Stockholm Syndrome came from a specific like bank robbery that had just happened. I thought this was like a well-studied, documented thing coming out of like, you know, the Freudian Institute. Mm-hmm. No, not true. And they give you really good context for whether people were talking about that at the time and whether people really bought into, I mean, that's a separate question as to whether people felt that Patty Hearst was responsible for anything that she might have done after she was taken. But here's clip 11, which is talking about the fact that Stockholm Syndrome as a term had just been invented by a bank robbery in Stockholm.
And it came to mean that hostages can identify with and sympathize with their captors. The bank robbery in Stockholm, in Sweden, had only taken place just months before the kidnapping. The story had not penetrated the popular culture yet. And even by the time Patty goes on trial in 1976, Stockholm Syndrome never came up. brainwashing did, which is a related but not identical concept to Stockholm Syndrome. Brainwashing was the core of her defense at the trial, but Stockholm Syndrome itself, which today is very much associated with the Patty Hearst case, was not in real time part of the national discussion.
That clip is a bit long, but I pulled it both because that was all new information to me and because it's very typical of Tubin's, like, very relaxed but also very informational style. I don't know how he does that. It's very cool. Maybe he should host this podcast. I don't think I can afford him. But yeah, that's, you get a lot of extra detail that's just like kind of snuck in there in this podcast.
And I like, and I had heard, like, when we talked about this and when it came out in the podcast, like, I think I knew the origins of Stockholm Syndrome, but I had no idea of the timing of it. And I think that was a little bit of a disservice that it was so soon to Patty Hearst's case, I guess, that that wasn't recognized, because you do see the differences between that and brainwashing. And I like that Tubin sort of did that too, that he talked about, you know, there are differences between the two, and I know they're associated, but, and then, because when he explains it like that, you can see the difference of it, that it's not just that you're brainwashed, because I think that it's easy sometimes to dismiss brainwashing too, because it's so abstract, and it feels kind of silly, and it's, you know, it's
well,
always
it's not a terribly
a joke,
nuanced
right?
term. No. Did you there happen you to read Bachelor Nation?
I did not.
Okay. basically, there's a lot in the, it's very good and informative. Yeah. If you liked the first season of Unreal, it's basically based on that, and it's great. But there are many references by past participants in the franchise to the fact that, like, you're cut off from the world, surrounded by this situation and only this situation. So when you, the viewer, are wailing at the TV, who cares? It's like they've been living on Pinot and insecurity for 6 weeks, and it has an effect. Yep. So,
And I was curious. I'm glad you brought the book up, because I was looking at it the other day. I've never watched The Bachelor. It's just never been my thing. But I've always been really curious, because I find, again, you know, I try to live this. I don't judge, I, you know, try to assume, and I don't know what other people's lives are, and it's easy, I find, to judge stuff like The Bachelor, but again, it's the context, but you miss that sometimes, and understanding where people get into these situations, and, you know, not to get on a soapbox, but I feel like if everybody can, you know, in the world sort of looks at it and goes, okay, I can take a minute to understand that I'm not that person. I don't know the situation they're in, and I'm not, you know, it's not easy for me to say what I would do in that. I think we can all be a little bit more accepting of one another, and, you know, the world will be a better place. But there is an element of that here too with Patty Hearst, of you can't assume what you would do in her situation, because as you know, the podcast goes to, nobody else has ever been in that situation.
Yeah.
So how do you know what you would do? And it's, you know, it's easy to judge.
Yeah. And it's sort of like that interviewer who asked George Harrison what it was like to be a Beatle. And he's like, what's it like not to be a Beatle? Yep. Like, we don't have the same vocabulary. Mm-hmm. I think it's telling that, this similarity between Monica Lewinsky's situation and Patty Hearst is telling to me, in that these were very bright, savvy survivors who were only given credit for their smarts and wherewithal in order to be portrayed as schemers.
Yes.
Who were guilty of something. And like Patty, think about it. This all happened in 1974. The rest of the cell is basically murdered 2 months later by the FBI in this huge firefight. And then she's on the run for a while.
Yeah.
There is an episode where they basically mention that in the wake of Hoover's death, the FBI was unable to locate even a single one of their butt cheeks with all of their hands. But that aside, She went all the way across the country.
Yeah,
she got somebody's parents to drive her. What?
And they were staying in someone's. I'm trying to remember this because it's coming back to me now as we talk about it from the TV series. But they were staying in someone's farmhouse, and there was a completely
different fugitive there.
Who
was okay, hot. They immediately recognized her, and I was like, "Is this farm upstate where they send the dog?" Except it's fugitives from justice. Was kind of amazing. I would watch an animated series set there.
Putting
that idea out there for free.
But the last clip that I asked to sort of be pulled, it really was, and the reason I liked it so much, I think it pulled together our two topics here in Monica Lewinsky and Patty Harrison talks about being a survivor. And yeah, again, how do you know what someone needs to do to survive that situation? And it's what you got to do sometimes. And
yeah, like maybe give her a little credit for her, mm-hmm. for her wherewithal, instead of assuming that it's tied to guilt and complicity of some kind.
Exactly.
Here's clip 12.
Patty Hearst, while her voice was soft when she spoke on the tape talking to her parents, she also exhibited a strength, whether she was against the SLA or later when she became a part of the group. And it was, feminism was still pretty new. So she was a strong female in an odd kind of way. She was feisty, and that came across. But of course, she was more than feisty because she was also carrying a gun into the Hibernia Bank. Patty Hearst is and was a survivor. She adapted to her environment. And I wouldn't call it Stockholm Syndrome so much as she figured out how to get along with whatever group of people she was with. And that meant in 1 month, pretty remarkably, it seemed, joining the SLA. But she was only 19 years old.
Exactly. And let's not confuse joining the SLA with going along with whatever they say so that they'll buy you sandwiches and cigarettes and not fucking kill you. Like,
exactly.
I don't know. How hard is this? How hard is this to understand? That.
Yeah.
Also, if I had a choice between Patty and Tanya as names, I'd take Tanya. I don't really care that she worked with Jay. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Sometimes you want to change.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah. So once again, that's Patty Has a Gun. It is from earlier this year. It is a podcast from CNN hosted by Brian Stelter and Jeffrey Toobin. They're mostly just talking about the case. And then the clip that we just heard was a reporter from, I think, The Chronicle. It was the Hearst paper.
Yeah.
And she also talks in that episode, which is episode 3, about the strictures that they, as a Hearst paper, had on how they reported it so that they didn't endanger Patty's life, which was interesting for this journalist. So,
yeah. I liked the interviews they had, too. Like, I found they were interesting, the different people they talked to and the context they gave. I liked it.
Yeah, same. And if you have a drive across the continent, American Heiress is also perfectly good, but if you need to get this shit done in 3 hours instead of 15 and a half... Patty Has a Gun, also also very interesting and gives good 70s texture.
Yeah. And the show was good too. The visuals and the, when we talked about the chaos, like the pictures and the video clips were good. I did recommend it.
All right, great. All of that will be in our show notes. Alex, where else can listeners find you?
The best place to find me is exposing my Canadian, as Tara Ariano likes to say, pinko views on Twitter at Alex N. Collins.
Outstanding. Thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, next time on The Blotter Presents, Eve Beatty gets smart. Pamela Smart, that is, with two takes on a case that's to die for. I'm sorry, but you know I had to. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents? Find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. Or you can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. You can become an official Blotter tipster at our Patreon page, patreon.com/blotter. My guest has been Alex Collins. She's on Twitter at Alex N. Collins. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.